Okay, I want to thank everybody for tuning in. We've got a great show coming up. Joe White from the Wall Street Journal is with us. Sandy Monroe from Monroe & Associates. We're going to be talking about a number of things here, including the presidential election and what the fallout might be for the auto industry. We want to look at Hyundai's fuel economy fiasco, Volkswagen's amazing employment level, and I've got some more information on what's going on at Lincoln. We're going to get going in just a moment.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet. Chevy runs deep.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 171 for November 9th, 2012. A breakthrough in automotive materials. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. Mr. DeLorenzo, man. God, you're almost a stranger to me. I haven't seen you in a while.
I know. I've been missing in action.
Good to see you, though.
Good to see you. How you been?
I've been doing pretty good. Been running around. We can talk about some of the stuff I've seen and learned. And also, we got Joe White from the Wall Street Journal with us
today. Hey, John. How are you?
Good to have you here, Joe.
It's good to be here.
Yeah. And, hey, before we really get going, we've got a lot of fans on the East Coast. And, man, our heart goes out to you guys. I hope things get straightened out there.
It's just miserable.
It is. Like I said, we've got some really good fans. I don't even know if they're able to watch the show right
now. Probably a lot of them aren't.
Because a lot of them are still in the dark or shivering in the cold. So we hope get all that gets straightened
out. How many vehicles were lost?
A couple hundred thousand is the estimate I've seen.
Really?
Yeah. The NADA is going with about 200,000.
And 300
Penske today Fiskers. Said that they lost 1,000. I think it was 1,000 at their dealerships in the East. And Fisker, 300. I mean, apparently Port of Newark, 16,000 are my colleagues reported yesterday.
Yeah. The only silver lining I see in all that is those cars and trucks are going to have to be replaced, and that's going to be a boost to car sales. So, but it's a bad way to get that
it's
kind of
It's a bad
boost.
Way to get that business. Yeah, absolutely.
So we just had the presidential election wrap up. You see any big impact from that going apropos the auto industry? Who cares about the rest of the stuff?
Yeah, I mean,
at least as far as this show goes.
You know, obviously the big speculation is when is GM, when is the government going to exit GM? And we were talking earlier, but I think it's by the end of the first quarter, if not sooner.
Yeah, if not sooner. I mean, I'll stipulate here that I have no inside knowledge, but you look at the share price of GM, and you look at it to get to break even, they need to hit $53 a share.
And where's it now? 23.
It's somewhere
something?
In the 20s.
It's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah, right.
That's number one. Number two, I think certainly at GM, and I think probably in most, even in the Obama administration, I think there's a general feeling that exiting GM is the right thing to do. I don't think President Obama wants to run a car company or own a car company. I think you're tired of that.
Right.
So why not? You know, here, take it from me. You know, why not sometime between now and the end of the year just say, here
I
you
agree
go.
With you. Do it before the end of the
take
year.
Take the loss, scrub the books,
right.
You know, the 2 days of bad headlines, and start all over again.
So before the State of the Union.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Now, obviously, you know, the Obama team probably is not looking to me for that advice, but it seems like politically a good time to do it is in this period when people, you know, it's the lame duck. People are focused on other things in Washington right now, fiscal cliff and all sorts of other issues. So,
yep. Good time.
Which, by the way, I think is relevant to the auto industry, and if we can talk about that if you
why?
Want.
Why? What do you mean?
Fiscal cliff. Well, so there's $600 billion in tax increases and federal spending cuts that are going to all happen on January 1. And already the business community is freaking out about this. And
they're frozen. They're not spending any money.
So that's bad to the extent that businesses, like people, buy cars and trucks. That's bad. To the extent that employees start to get the chill from that kind of talk, that's bad. To the extent that the stock market starts to go in a tailspin like it has been for the last couple of days, that's bad. So these are all bad things that you don't want to see kind of pouring cold water on the party here, because the auto car market's been great, relatively.
It's one of the few bright spots in the economy. Maybe the only bright spot in the economy.
Certainly one of the few.
Yeah.
I don't think this country can afford to go slide back in a recession again.
No.
It would hurt bad.
No.
It would hurt bad.
So I think that is a post-election event. I think getting rid of GM and getting that back into private hands is something that would probably behoove this time frame. I mean, sometime now in the first quarter will be just as good a time as any. And doing it all at once, there's probably arguments against that. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, if you're going to take a loss,
take your loss. Take your one riot now. Like you're saying, next year is a new year. Everyone's going to be focused on all this other stuff. Get rid of it right now. Mm-hmm. Just sell the shares.
This is a debate that's gotten very tired and very stale. And again, the GM has made it, I think Dan Ackerson and his people have made it about as clear as they can possibly make it, that they want the government out of their affairs. And for better or worse, I think they're probably right to believe that and feel that.
Yep, I agree. Another big thing that broke in the last week is this fuel economy fiasco at Hyundai. Peter, you wrote about it.
I think it's going to be a disaster. Other people say, it'll be a blip. I don't think it's going to be a blip. I think it's going to be costly, a lot more than $100 million. And I've been hearing from a lot of readers, more than normal, say, this isn't new. This one guy wrote, we got a Hyundai and 2008 hasn't ever gotten anywhere near the mile. But, I take that with a grain of salt.
I take that with a grain of salt because, what they got nailed on for the most part was about a 1 mile per gallon ding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but see, I don't think it was a procedural error.
That's very curious. Yeah.
I don't. Right. The Korean automotive executive mindset, they want to win at all costs. Their schedules. Remember in Patton when George C. Scott, the guy brought in the extra star, and what's that actor's name with the big Carl Malden, who was playing? I forget.
Omar Bradley.
Yeah, and he said, George, don't you think you ought to wait? They got their schedules. I've got mine. The Koreans have their schedules. They believe they think they're going to be a luxury competitor. They're going to do this. They're going to do that. And for the most part, they hit. But I think when they don't, procedural errors doesn't make sense to me.
Well, there's a couple of things that I'd say about that. Number one is, I think they could manage their way. I can and could manage their way out of this and make it a blip. They probably ought to go to school. Both in a negative and a positive way on how Toyota has managed to get itself clear of the sudden acceleration fiasco that they had a couple of years ago. And I think if you look at Toyota's latest sales, you'd have to say they've managed to rebound from that.
But it was also proven that it was driver error.
Well, that's right. And they don't probably have that going for them here at Hyundai. Yeah. And I think they've got more mea culpas. But I think you alluded to at least a couple of other problems. Number one, I don't think the government is done with them.
No.
To your point, I don't think the government is probably satisfied that this was just an innocent mistake. And that could be harmful and damaging if there's a subsequent finding that, yes, this was deliberate, if they did that. Number two, the lawyers are at work as we speak doing class action suits. Some of these sort of diminution of value suits don't have a good track record, but again, it's reputational damage. So they're going to have to put a lot of work into undoing damage to an image that they would spend better part of a decade rebuilding, and doing quite well.
They were doing brilliant.
They were doing great. It was a company that had great design and kind of integrity around their offer, and this is not good for any of that.
That's right. So we'll see. I think they'll get beyond this, because Toyota was able to do it, although for different reasons. But a decade ago or better, Ford was getting excoriated for the tire failures on the Explorer, and took them time and a lot of money, but they got through that.
They'll get beyond it, but things are going to not look good. Like Kraft just get it up in front of the media every chance he gets, saying we are the 40 mile per gallon car company, and we
they're going to be and they're hugely embarrassed by this. No question about it. Okay, we beat that horse to death. Well, not really, but. Hey, another thing I wanted to talk about that I've been astonished to learn, and I only picked this up when I was at the Paris Auto Show, and Volkswagen Group does a huge presentation. Every single one of their brands comes out and But what they announced that I had never seen before is they have a total employment level of 550,000 people working for that company. That's more than General Motors and Ford and Fiat Chrysler put together. Now, those companies put together built 10 million more vehicles than Volkswagen did. Mm-hmm. So if you were to go in and look at this and say, well, how many employees does Volkswagen need to build a car? How much revenue does Volkswagen generate per employee? Any efficiency expert, any business school graduate would look at this and say, this company's a basket case. They don't know what they're doing. And yet, Volkswagen has more revenue and higher profits than any other car company in the world, and by a wide margin. Last year, their operating profit was $14 billion, which I say, now you're starting to get up into big oil money. Mm-hmm. You know, this is not what you expect from a car company. And I'm just blown away by this on two levels. Number one, that they have so many people. And number two, that I've only just discovered this. And nobody else in the rest of the industry seems to be aware of how many people work at Volkswagen. To me, they are like when General Motors was great. You know, back in the late 1960s, mm-hmm. General Motors had 750,000 people, and it was the most profitable car company, profitable corporation the world.
They were the corporation.
Right.
Were.
That's right. But I think there's important lessons to take out of this. Number one, Volkswagen's quite vertically integrated, more than other car companies. So they've shown, you know, mm-hmm. if you do stuff in-house and you do it well, you actually save a lot of money, because if you're buying stuff from suppliers, that supplier's got to have a profit. Well, if you do it in-house, you keep the profit.
Yeah, but you said the key phrase is you do it well.
Do it well, right.
And that is, I think, with Volkswagen. And you know, I'm not here to promote Volkswagen too far, but the success tells you that what this is about is the people who run the joint. It's the management.
Well, yeah. It's executional excellence. I mean, they really...
It's all that, but I think it goes deeper. I think that, you know, when GM had 8 or 9 brands and Ford had 8 or 9 brands, they had very good people. They really did. It didn't work at all. Why, in my view? Because they tried to centralize everything. They centralized design. They centralized engineering. They centralized manufacturing. And they just treated these brands simply as that, brands, something that you can market. Whereas what Volkswagen does is each one of its so-called brands is really a standalone car company with its own board of directors, its own annual report, its own design studio, engineering, manufacturing. And yeah, they share some amount of platform and powertrain, some amount, mm-hmm. and they share in purchasing. But that's it. Other than that, these operations run alone. So you think back of General Motors up through really the late 60s, maybe the early 70s. If you were the head of Chevrolet, you ran a car company, same as what Volkswagen's doing now. You don't have your own board of directors and all that, but you had your own design, your own engineering, your own manufacturing, sales, marketing, advertising, the whole nine yards. And so I'm intrigued at that as Cadillac and Lincoln try to revive themselves, try to make themselves really relevant in the luxury segment. I think that's the way to go. I think that just putting somebody in charge of marketing isn't going to get the job done. I think they got to break them off as totally standalone
Toyota,
companies.
Toyota just recently, within the last year or so, did that with Lexus.
Did they really?
Yeah, they gave them more autonomy. They gave them for this very reason.
Look at what Infiniti's done. They just moved their headquarters out of Japan, hired Johan Dennison from Audi, and said, mm-hmm. boom, you run this thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's right. But I think with Volkswagen, though, it's interesting. Now, you know, Volkswagen has executed a strategy with its main brand, the Volkswagen brand, which I think helps them get away with the sort of the staffing levels and all of the structure that you're talking about. Volkswagen is still basically a premium-priced and premium-positioned product, uh-huh. even though it is the people's car. And they do it here in the United States, and I think they do it in Europe still, and I think they do it in China.
Most of the world. Right?
So as long as you're earning more revenue per car to pay for all of this, and I think they do it across most of their brands. I can't speak to maybe Seat or something like that. And they've built up Audi so that it's generating
a lot of money.
A lot of money. And So again, it's executional excellence, what you said. That's the thing. Now, if they do what our friends in Detroit did in the 80s and the 90s, and particularly the 80s, and they let quality go to heck and they lose their brand positioning and they wander off into the weeds as to what a Cadillac or a Lincoln is supposed to be and take less revenue with each successive model year, well, this isn't going to work.
Yeah, but, you know, Volkswagen's always been at the bottom of J.D. Power's initial quality report. Audi has done somewhat better, you know. They've never been recognized for stellar quality.
Well, and I would submit to you that that's a risk. I mean, they get by on terrific product concept and terrific designs.
Well, and that's
not
the
all
other
of them terrific,
of the
but many of them are.
They're brilliant. You know, there's a couple of ways to measure quality. One way is things gone wrong. That's where the Japanese are fantastic. Mm-hmm. And the Europeans or even the Americans are not as good. But when it comes to things gone right, Volkswagen's really good. People love their cars.
Volkswagen does curb appeal really well.
Right.
I mean, their cars look great. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they can't get away with the lousy quality forever.
No, and you said earlier it would be interesting to parachute Ferdinand Piëch and his chief staff people over to GM and see how they'd be running.
Yeah, that would be a great...
What was that line of Bear Bryant that you were saying?
Well, when they were talking about Bear Bryant...
Famous football coach.
Yeah, but the idea is Piëch and his people come in and take GM, and you said in 60 days it'd be a different company, and I agree. And there's a famous thing about Bear Bryant, and it was the adage was he could take his'n and beat yours'n, or he could take yours'n and beat his'n.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's right. I think that a lot of it has to do with management. You know, the
leadership counts.
You know, you look at all the car companies in the world; they're not run all the same way.
No,
you know, there is kind of a consensus around centralization that Volkswagen is an outlier to that. You're right about
very
that.
Much so.
But all these car companies are run a different way, and some are successful and some are not. You know, and some are kind of both at the same time, like Fiat Chrysler in a way. I mean, you know, Fiat has all these problems in Europe. But Sergio Marchionne is a heck of a CEO, and he's taken Chrysler and stood it back up on its feet, and they're gaining market share. And you know, we can argue about whether they can do it for the long run without some more stuff. But leadership and people matter.
And Mulally's even the better example.
And Alan Mulally's a better example. He pretty much came more or less by himself with a Ford culture that everybody in town, including Ms. Bill Ford, knew was dysfunctional, and they clearly weren't making any money. Look at them now.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, people matter.
People matter, but structure and processes matter as well. And I think that Volkswagen's got it nailed with this decentralization approach. You know, it's very interesting. Alfred Sloan, who ran General Motors, and everybody at GM and the business schools all bow down in obeisance to Sloan. Mm-hmm. He was adamant about decentralization. In the Great Depression, around 1931 or something, his staff came to him and said, look, we're losing our ass here. We got to figure out some way of cutting costs. We suggest that we combine Buick, Pontiac, and Oldsmobile. They called it BOP, mm-hmm. Put them all together. And Sloan was very reluctant, and they worked on him. Finally, he relented and said, let's put these three together. We're going to centralize things, eliminate duplication and overlap, and we're going to really start to save some money. 16 months later, he said, no, I don't care how much money we're saving. This is the wrong way to go. And he undid it and stood them back up as standalone companies mm-hmm. again. Mm-hmm. And he had to fight that fight all the way into the late 50s. I think he retired in 1959 is when I want to say. He stepped off the board at that point. 4 years later comes GMAD, General Motors Assembly right. Division, where they started to centralized.
Well, and they've been restructuring the company more or less ever since. Pretty much.
Right. And they all come in, all these business school graduates, and I don't mean to pick on them too much, but I will, and they all have these visions of, hey, we can eliminate overlap and duplication, and we can get a lot more efficient, we're going to save all this money, and they've never saved a dime. They just haven't.
Well, I obviously wasn't around for Alfred Sloan, but I've talked to people who've studied what he did at GM and read his book and the whole thing. A lot of what Alfred Sloan, again, had going for him was that he, at the center of this kind of, you know, helter-skelter of different car companies all operating, you know, sort of autonomously, was pretty iron-fisted discipline around capacity and around, you know, people. If you gave someone capital, They were expected to produce a return, and if they didn't, it's not good.
And General Motors, the holding company, was the bank. So they owned all these companies,
like,
and you had to turn the profits
company
over to them. And when you needed capital to do stuff, you had to go to the bank. And that's how they maintained that financial discipline. You had to go down on the boulevard and say, here's what I need for the next year.
Right.
And they had every one of these companies coming to them, including Frigidaire and Electromotive and a bunch of other non-automotive things. So that's how they maintained that discipline. And that's how they maintained their view of the total corporation, is they were the bank. And if you wanted things done, you had to go to the bank to get it done. I'll bet Volkswagen's very similar to that. I don't know how their financial maneuverings internally, but I'll bet you it's not that far off the mark.
Well, there's, I mean, the results tell you that there's rigor and discipline, because otherwise, with that much, you know, going on, you'd have chaos, and it would show in the results. And so far, it isn't.
Yeah.
Well, one other interesting thing about PIAC. You know, everyone, Porsche is coming back to Le Mans in 2014, and everyone expected that the edict would come down from top, that Audi will sit out now that they've dominated Le Mans for 11 out of the last 13 years or something. But then PIAC went on record a month ago or so and said, oh, no, I expect them to compete against each other.
I love it.
Okay.
That's the right approach. And, of course, this Piak came out of Porsche Racing, did the 917.
He's a Porsche.
Right, yeah.
He designed some of the greatest Porsche racing cars of all time, including my favorite, the 908-3. Mm-hmm. But he's also, like, you know, this maniacal genius, you know?
Yeah.
Just wild.
Well, yeah, I've mainly watched his results. It's not like I've spent a lot of time with the gentleman. But he's a guy of iron will. And he also is a guy with reasonably good product instincts.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he's got
great product instincts. Right. He, you know, and I'm sure he knows how to deal with money or hire people who do. But I think they prosper from his product instincts.
He's an engineer's engineer with a tremendous racing pedigree, now running what I would argue to be the most successful car company in the world.
And he has made his share of big-time mistakes, like the Phaeton.
Yep.
But, and a few dozen others, but, you know.
Hey, it's like the venture capital guys. All you need is a couple of big ones to hit, and it takes care of all the other problems.
He swings for the fences every time.
Right, and they're making money. They're making money where a lot of their European competitors are not. And I think...
You
hear the howling from their European
Marchionne. It's so bad in Europe that Marchionne basically suggested collusion. Said, well, let's all get together and agree upon our profit margins. And it was like PIAC and Volkswagen said, what are you talking about?
No, they're gonna take as much market share as this situation will allow.
Yeah.
And if they wake up in a couple of years and there's one or two fewer major players in the European auto market,
they're not gonna cry.
C'est la vie.
C'est la vie.
Or however you say that in German.
Auf Wiedersehen.
Right. Hey, let's take a break right now because we got to get Sandy Monroe on the show. So Ben, let's give a shout out to our friends at Bridgestone. Every time.
You know what? I'm just going to these things right now because they just make noise.
Okay, we're back, and we're back with Mr. Sandy Monroe of Monroe & Associates, and welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you very much, John. Thank you.
It's been a couple of years.
Yes. It's about a year. Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, it's like a one-year event. It's like Christmas.
Yeah.
At least for me, anyway. Yeah. So it's been about a year. Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm going to ask a question because I know our viewers will ask it. What's the update on Covetic Aluminum? Because you opened that to the world on this show.
Yes, I did. And actually, I'm going to open it a little bit more because...
you brought props.
I did. What, isn't that what you bring me for? It's like Christmas.
Well, they don't call him Mr. Wizard
Sandy Claus. It's Sandy Claus. Anyways, I have news for yous. And basically, with Covetic Aluminum... they're going to tell the world how you do it.
Who is?
Covetic Aluminum.
That's the name of the company?
That is the name of the, it's got a different name.
It's Ralph Covetic?
But it's, I'm telling you.
Is he related to Alcantara?
Alcantara.
Favorite product.
Yeah. Anyways, the deal is that, and as soon as I find it, I will tell you, but they're going to post it on their website. They're going to say, here it is. You guys wanted to say you couldn't do it? Well, some university in Poland, they figured it out. And they said, hey, you know what? This stuff's amazing. And as soon as
I thought it was some company in Ohio that had it.
It is.
Oh, okay.
It is. But a university in Poland got into they looked at what they had. They took a few very good guesses, and he wound up cracking a code. And so now, in a few days, they're going to be posting this on their website. How do you make Covetic aluminum? They don't care, because if somebody's figured it out, they'll put it up. So they're going to put their stuff up, and they're going to. And this is it. www.covetic is spelled COVETIC.info. Okay? And it's not up there right now, but.
And for anybody who didn't catch the earlier show, explain Covetic
I'm the only person in the room who doesn't know what Covetic aluminum
is. I'm sorry, we can't tell you.
You just did.
Okay, well, there you go. Actually, Covetic aluminum is magic. If you're an engineer and somebody says magic, you say magic equals bullshit. But in this particular case, it's magic. This magic is like nothing. Okay, here's the deal. You take 7074 aluminum, which it doesn't mean much to you, but if you're an aircraft guy, that's the best there is. Mm-hmm. There's nothing like it. It's magic. However, it machines terribly. I used to be a toolmaker a long time ago. That's not a thing I wanted to machine. It sticks and it bites. It doesn't like to be poured. It doesn't like anything, but it's really strong when it's in a T6 state, which means that it's heat treated and it takes a long time and costs a lot of money. This stuff, they took the 7074 or 7075, I can't remember which one. They took it, they turned it into Covetic 7074. Then they poured it and they did all the tests that you do with non-Covetic 7074, and guess what? They got better results, neat. No heat treat, no nothing.
So explain that. What do you mean?
So what can I do with the Covetic aluminum if I'm making cars? What can I do with it?
Like I said, it's magic. You can do almost anything with this stuff. It takes the place of pretty much anything that we've got in the marketplace right now. There's nothing like it, nothing. And not only that, when you go to these Covetics,
What is Covetic? What does that mean?
It just means that it's Covetic means that it's two different entities that are kind of molded together. Now, there's been lots and lots of metal matrix products and whatnot. This has infused carbon nano filaments, which you can't see them. Filaments are a pipe, basically. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's inside there and it's permanent. You can take it and you can melt it, and it doesn't come out of solution like other materials. This stuff just goes on and on and on and on. It doesn't change its characteristics, and you don't have to heat treat it. It machines the pieces we've been fooling around with. It machines beautifully, and actually, I got these things here.
And it stretches without tearing.
And
right?
It stretches forever.
So you can put it in a stamping press.
I can stamp it. I can machine it. I can cast it. I can forge it. Although I don't know why, because I can get castings that kind of equal forgings. And I will send you all of this stuff here, because this is all public domain now. Our wonderful government has been funding quite a bit of information. And remember, I just said 7074, change that to 7075. So here's 7075 neat right there, okay? Okay, that's 482 MPA. And maybe somebody else might like the KISS number 62.
Yeah, I flunked metallurgy.
Yeah, I'm not going to go to it. You know what? I'm going to stop right now. So let's just say that the number here is 428, and this is neat. Then they infused the carbon. When they infused the carbon, they compared it to aluminum that was heat treated. These are all samples from the same pieces, right? So this is all aircraft quality 7075, and so they took half of it and melted it down and made it Covetic, and they took the other stuff just the way it was and took measurements there. So they went over and they said, okay, here we are, and we're going to now heat treat this to T6. So it goes from 428 to 585, Okay, just trust me on this. It means it's a lot stronger. And then they poured the Covetic at 5%. Neat. No nothing. And guess what? It goes up to 607.
Even stronger.
Even stronger. It's amazing. This stuff is, like I say,
So let's say I wanted to build my next Ford F-150 out of this stuff.
No, there's not enough of it around.
There's a problem.
There's no massive. It would have to be tested. It took almost three years. It took a whole bunch of agencies just to find that there was actually nanotubes in there. It took them that long to figure it out, and it was just by sheer accident that somebody broke it just in the right way, and you could see it didn't shear the way it was normally going to shear, and when it broke, they could find little carbon radiuses all over the place. That's the only sample that they had. And I'm telling you what, these guys have, the guys that are on this, Lou Ludke and Jason Shugard, these guys have gone to hell and back trying to get people to look at it and metallurgists to say, no, it's just neat. There's nothing here to look at, nothing here. It's just like watching a South Park going over and over and over again. Nothing to see, move along. But now they found it, and now it's irrefutable. And by the way, this stuff doesn't corrode. Aluminum corrodes. Everybody says, well, it doesn't rust. Well, no, it doesn't, but it does corrode. This is great for ships. This is fabulous for airplanes. And guess what? Cars like it when it doesn't corrode, too. So there's a lot of good attributes. And then its ductility is just out of this world. And by the way, it's not just aluminum. You can do that with copper. Oh, and by the way, when you do copper, this is amazing. With copper, when you get up around 350 degrees, it has a tendency to lose its ability to conduct. This stuff gets better. This stuff gets better at 350 than it was when it was at zero.
So again, I flunked metallurgy, but what I hear you saying is that this connects to something that I'm really interested in, which is that, you know, 54.5 cafe is this big, everybody's tearing their hair out, it's terrible. But I get the sense that, well, wait, let me finish.
Oh, my gosh, I've got something for you to look at,
right,
too.
So what this tells me is that,
Claus is a present.
That innovation is happening in response to this demand for lighter materials, novel materials, materials that will do stuff that old materials can't do.
Right.
I'm trying to connect what you're telling me with that trend. Is there a connection?
Like I said, that material is magic. And I will send you, so you can put it up on your webpage and whatnot, I'll send you the little information that came from an independent study, and you can have a look at it, and you can draw your own conclusions. And I guarantee you that those firmly embedded in the way things have always been will deny that this is possible, and they'll keep on denying it, because that's just the way people are. But for those of us who are looking for an opportunity, with a skeptical eye, I mean, you can ask anybody in the industry. Lots of people come with their big projects to Monroe & Associates, and they come into our little sales room, and a guy puts it down, and he tells me something, and I say, really? Can we get some proof? Well, no, but I have deep down in my soul, the day is over, you're out. And we've thrown out hundreds of people with the next big thing. But this, when he came in, he said, I've got this piece of copper that doesn't corrode. Really? Yep, it won't corrode at all. Can I see it? Thanks. I walked out of the door. I walked over to the door that's to our, like there's a field right next door to us. I opened it up, whoosh, closed the door. I said, we'll come back and have a look at that in about a year, and we'll see if it's corroded. I was going to bring that piece too. It still hasn't corroded. It's been handled and everything else. It didn't turn green. It didn't turn black. It didn't do anything. It's just as bright as a brand new penny. It doesn't corrode. This stuff is, I tell you what, there's a lot of folks that are saying we need this and we need that. We've got it sitting in these two products anyways.
So what's the catch? Volume production?
Volume production. These guys can't get real funds. So being as you're at the Wall Street
Journal.
I
know a venture capitalist who's looking for something to do as of yesterday.
As of yesterday.
Bingo. You guys got to talk
after
the
show. Hang on a second. Here. Hang on. I got a card right here.
You've heard his name.
There we go.
It'll come to you.
There you go.
Now.
There you go. Yeah.
Boston? Yeah, he's in Boston. He's a poor guy. He's got nothing to do. He has this big family to support.
Wait a minute. I think I've got nothing to do.
What else you got in that bag?
Yeah, what else you got in that bag? Well, hang on a second.
You're talking about high field economy, and all of a sudden you lit up and reached into your bag.
Well, I did. You heard about that fuel economy study, right? Who did that study anyway?
Which study?
Which?
There's been so many.
One for the 54 miles per gallon.
Oh, there's been a zillion.
Yeah, there's been.
Yeah, there has. But there's only one that the government kind of took any note of. So I have this book.
So you're the guy to blame, right?
Here it is right here. Wow, I just happen to have one here in this bag.
I've got one of those right by my bedside every night.
Yeah. Oh, yeah? Well,
what's on one page?
What's on one page? Page 192.
What
anyways, this says how you take a Venza and turn it into
a Toyota Venza.
And
so this is your reverse engineering study.
Yes. This isn't just mine. The Monroe & Associates was definitely a participant. The guys leading the parade were FEV. And we also had EDAG to make sure that they scanned the whole body and everything.
So we should just say FEV does a lot of powertrain consultancy work, yeah. And EDAG builds a lot of prototypes.
And they also do a lot of testing and validation. And Monroe & Associates does the costing, innovation, new materials, blah, blah, blah. But we didn't really do high-end innovation on this car. And we got to 54 miles per gallon. And we you know what?
You tore apart a Venza and figured out how to make it get to 54?
A 2010 Venza, and this is how you get it to that wonderful mileage. And when this thing was read through, I'll give you those too, the reviewers, we saw, I didn't, because I'm the boss. I'm not going to go to these congressional hearings. I've heard that you can have your head handed back to you. But my guys went, Al Steyer was one of them, went, and he's sitting in there in the pews and whatnot, waiting for his turn, and they brought one character up after another and, shredded them because they didn't have their act together. They didn't know what they were talking about. They didn't have the true nuts and bolts, dollars and cents data that could make anything happen. On the other hand, with a peer review, we got tremendous results. They liked the numbers. They said that they were fair and equitable.
Who said that?
That would be the Congressional Review Board.
Okay.
So
what did Toyota say?
Toyota?
Yeah.
Okay. This is another little funny story. The Greg Kolich is the lead for the whole project. He's the lead, but he's also the lead at FEV, and he put on a speech. Down in it was in Boston, I think, the lightweight the weight reduction conference or something like that. They're all sounded like the same, but anyways, this is the first time he was going to talk, and he was not the keynote speaker. And he was on a planetary kind of session, and he went in. He started out. He had a full audience at the end of the conference. He was 100% full, standing room only. People basically want to know how all this stuff came about. The Toyota guys, because this book, not this one, but one like it, was put out, and they said, you know, have a look. It's public domain. You can have a look. We'll just show you what we came up with. And this is low innovation. This is stuff that can be done right this very second.
What's the cost? What's the cost differential plus or minus for taking a Venza and doing what you do in that study?
It reduced the cost by over $100.
Reduced the cost.
Hang on a second.
Who funded this, Sandy? Who paid for this study?
This is the EPA, our next best friends.
So yeah, that would EPA, be all of us.
That would be, yes, all of us. And where's my little notes? I'd like to know. But anyways, I will find them in a second. The long and short of it is it dropped. It's $140-something. We got rid of a couple hundred pounds, and this is kind of like I said, this is the low end stuff. There's a high end study that hasn't been released yet. High end, like I would say, more advanced kinds of things, and in that study, what's this? This is carbon fiber. This is carbon fiber, but it's plastic injection molded.
You can't do that.
What's the part that you're showing us? What is that?
This, Well, this is a crossbow mount. Now, I don't know. Do you guys use crossbows? I do. Okay.
For now, like a hunting deer kind
yes,
of thing?
Okay. Yes, I do. Yeah. Right. So so the long and short of it is...
located here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So anyways...
I love deer hunting, too.
This thing is something that I just found out about. Right now, actually, I left there to come here. We're having a little design charrette. It's the latest word.
Charrette? What's charrette. That mean?
It means like brainstorming exercise, but yeah. It's much more fancy with the charrette right. thing. I'm getting into it. I'm changing and all my stuff.
And to get into one, you have to be dressed like Peter all in black.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly right. Anyway, this guy here, his name is Stephen Bowen, and he's been doing this forever. And that was because nobody knew over in Winona, Minnesota, nobody knew that you couldn't do this. I mean, they didn't tell this guy, you can't do this stuff. And I want you to stop immediately. He's going to sell me a bushel basket. He's going to send me a bushel basket full of parts that he's been making like this. And I mean, he's got all the data to say that this is the real deal.
But is this chopped fiber or is this continuous
fiber? It's continuous, but they chop it as it's going into the screw.
But then you don't get the strength of the fiber.
Oh, yes, you do. That's plenty strong.
Well,
we were amazed.
It's a pretty thick piece.
It is a thick piece, but that's because they need also the stability. It needs to take the shock. When that thing goes, it's like your front leaf spring or an old leaf spring in the rear of a car going. It's pretty dramatic. I have a crossbow, not that one, but I may switch to this one. But I'm telling you what, and this thing, you have to drop it from a tree and all kinds of other things. Normally, the main housing, which this represents, they don't last too long. And right now, we're going through this little charrette, and we've picked three parts. A front seat, a cross car beam, that one got rejected because there wasn't enough in it. But the engine cradle, the seat, and a door. A door is in the inner. We're not taking any Class A surfaces. We're just looking at those kinds of products because they're the easiest to implement. And because of the crashworthiness characteristics of carbon fiber is like a lot better than what we can get out of even magnesium. So this is the kind of stuff that's not in this book. This is the type of stuff, though, that we're working on right now. And hopefully, if things go well, Monroe will be picked to be the center of excellence for...
But carbon fiber is still so expensive.
No, it's not. It used to be about $45 a pound. And by the way, I should tell
you... Now it's only 15, right?
Now it's only 15. But remember, it's
and
volume.
Steel is what, 25 cents?
Well, that's true. But the problem is that if I can't hit my weight targets, I don't have a car. So right. How much is it worth now?
Well, I know that.
You know, that's and the value.
But see, that's where my problem with the fuel economy standards is, yeah, we're getting all this really cool innovation and technology.
I think it's true. Yeah.
But the only reason we're doing it is because now the car companies don't have a choice. They've got to increase their prices. And we're seeing car prices go up almost $1,000 a year now.
Well, I think Chrysler just announced a couple of weeks ago that they're going to go up and they're going to raise their prices by 10%. And you know what? For a long time, we watched the auto industry dwindle and wither and
yeah, but I also
die.
Remember the days of sticker shock when people went, it costs what? And we're going right back to that now.
I don't think, I personally don't think that was a good move. When we started saying, well, we're going to give discounts and stuff like that, that was kind of like what I call Boston math. Oh, we'll make it up. You know, we're going to lose a little on every car, but we'll make it up in volume. It doesn't work that way. Same as vertical integration. I've always chuckled. Every time somebody says that vertical integration is bad, really? So you're saying that all I want to do at the end of the day is just pick up that badge and go and call it my car? Yeah. You know what? You lose all of your IP. All your IP is going to vanish because you'll not have anything in-house. That's why Ford and General Motors and Chrysler is kind of like vanished because they didn't bring anything new to the party and people get tired of the old, same old, same old. That's why Volkswagen, they may not have the world's best quality, but... they got the world's biggest bank account. The guy that keeps going back in, and by the way, I noticed that actually even in your paper as well, you keep calling it the Sloan mentality. You shouldn't do that. Sloan would, he'd be spinning in his grave and he'd tear the throats out of people that said it. This is not the Sloan mentality. It comes from the Boston area. I don't want to get into it, but it's not Sloan. It has nothing to do with Sloan. Sloan's mentality was, if we've got pride in each one of these different divisions, or actually car companies, and they pay the bank, as you were saying, we'll be successful. People forget psychology is in there somewhere, too. It's not just technology, and it's just not efficiency. You've got to have the psychology. And if the psychology is, well, we're a big place, and if I don't come to work today, it's no big wow, and I don't have to do that, and I'm not responsible for this. And what was that? There was that program. That's not my job. I can't remember the – but anyway, that kind of a thing, that's not my job. Well, you know what? If you've got a Sloan kind of person that's at the top, and he picks people just like him in the, each one of these different car companies, and they pick the people down below it, oh, yeah, it's not going to be pleasant coming to work. Oh, my gosh, it's probably not going to be politically correct either. But you know – excuse me, you know what? They win. Mr. Piek, is he a wonderful guy? Would he give you a kiss on both cheeks? Would he say,
I've never seen or heard
it today? I'm so interested in her. No, I don't think so. So I think that the one thing I would like to suggest is that we don't say things like that's the Sloan mentality, because it isn't. It's nothing to do with him. His name should be removed from that. There's a bunch of heroes from the past that are kind of like been slandered. Henry Ford and his vertical integration. Oh, that'll never work. Well, you know what? I can tell you for sure that centralization and farming it out to everybody else so that this will give me time to sit back and read the newspaper and not really worry about anything. And if that supplier doesn't do his job well, it doesn't really matter. I mean, that's what kills car companies.
Hey, another thing I wanted to get to while we've got you here is you did a cost analysis of what it takes GM to build the Chevy Volt and came out with a pretty high number.
It's actually probably low now. I came up with probably somewhere between, and this was over the phone and whatnot. The guy came at me pretty much out of the blue and said, the Chevy Volt, how much is it worth? I don't know. I didn't really pay much attention. We did tear them down. If you go to on to Google and you just put in Chevy Volt teardown, I guarantee you you're going to see about a half a dozen of my guys tearing a Volt to pieces. And we looked at a lot of stuff. Mostly we were looking for technology. And I will tell you, I was impressed. There was a lot of great technology inside that Volt. We really liked it. Okay, I think it was a great experiment, and that's what I said on TV a couple of times. It was a great experiment. This guy phones up and he says, hey, how much does a Chevy Volt really cost?
To make.
And I said, well, I don't know. It's about $1 billion to do a car, but that car's got a different powertrain in it. And I don't know, that means you're going to have another, I don't know, 200, 250 million. And so $1.2 billion. And then the normal car costs about $18,000 if you're looking at, $75,000 a year. And and I came up with $55,000 or $60,000. Well, I was way off, because I had people phoning me up saying, oh, you missed the boat here, Sandy. You said $1.2 billion, but that's not right. You forgot that we had a bankruptcy in between there. You didn't take that into consideration. You know what? When there's a lot of people sitting around, they don't have any leadership, that price goes up. And by the way, you didn't take into account that there's a lot of other things going on that that the rest of the public, the world doesn't know about. Like, how about this one? The Volt, no jolt. Did you guys read this little article here?
No.
Yeah. There would be 40 of us just sitting around all day. I mean, this is the battery.
It's a battery factory.
Yeah. Nobody built anything. I mean, that's something I did not take into account, didn't know about. I didn't know how much money got sunk into this thing with the promise to these different suppliers. And the suppliers are saying, cross my palm with gold. You have not given me volume. Where is my mania? You know, that kind of stuff. That starts bringing the price up. So
what
now,
do you think? 65,000?
70, maybe. 65, 70,000 a pop. And even though they're going to probably hit their target of 20,000 this year, it's not going to be a moneymaker. And so what I got upset about was, why did they go and say, you know, this is a car we're going to make money on, or this is profitable? Well, that's a bloody lie. Why didn't they come out and say, you know what? We tried an experiment. We did the bold thing. We did, and because, you know what? I've got a whole bunch of comments on tape long before this came out. Hey, these controllers are brilliant. Hey, look at the way this fit and finish is for a brand new car. Hey, look at this. Look at that. Look at that. This is really good stuff.
So do you think General Motors could ever recover this investment by taking some of that technology that you just mentioned and spreading it out across the line?
It's hard to say. I think that some of the stuff that they've done might be transferable, but you got to remember, when you've got a new car, everything changes. Everything's different. Nothing's the same. Nothing stays static. And so consequently, you design for today, but today is 5 years ago, really, because when you've designed it, it takes 5 years to get the car on the road. So now I've got it on the road, things have changed, and, you know, time marched on, and new innovation has come along. And so now your product is 5 years old. Are you going to take that five-year-old thing and put it into something else? Because remember, when you take it out of that five-year-old product and put it into here, even if it's on day one, well, that's five more years. Now you're going to hit the market with something that's 10 years old, and the electronics world, 18 months is, that's a long time. Mm-hmm. And that's what it's all boiled right down to. But I'll tell you what, the controllers that we looked at, the circuit boards we looked at when we tore it apart, and if you go there, that there's no math, no science, it's just kind of like comments. But if you go and look at that, it's an amazingly well done bunch of controllers and circuit boards.
But really expensive.
It's expensive only because there's no volume. Throw the volume at it. I mean, if they could sell 65,000, 70,000 of those a year, it would be an expensive car to build. But, I mean, the first year was, six, next year was like eight or something like that, and this year we're looking at 20. I mean, that's, you're looking at Rolls-Royce kind of volumes, you know, or Bentley. I mean, that's not, you can't make any money at that. Just not, and there's nothing basically common on it. It's a product that was an experiment, and for that they should be applauded. And for whoever it was that said, no, we're making money. Don't. What does he know? He doesn't know anything. That's not true. I got this
and,
big
and
book.
So it's not to pick on
yeah, there you go, that big book.
So it's not just to pick on GM too. This would be true of all the other electric car makers.
Any electric car maker is going in and making an experiment, and they're trying to figure out for a lot of things. First off, is the technology there? Are my supply community is it there? Is it ready to go? Is the buying public ready for this kind of a thing? And they're staying away in droves, which kind of tells you a little bit. It's an expensive experiment. They should take credit for that, but not tell the world.
There's a couple of problems I see with electric cars, but it seems like the biggest one, and the one that always stops me in my tracks, is the chart. And this is another thing you can find on the internet: the chart that shows the relative energy density of a lithium ion or lead acid battery down here, and a gallon of gasoline.
Absolutely.
Up here. And, you know, that's a tough thing to overcome. And from my understanding is that there's no Moore's law, you know, doubling the energy density of lithium ion every 18 months or anything.
Not even close.
No, not until we get to lithium crystals. Once that happens.
Dilithium crystals.
Oh, sorry. Did you watch Star Trek?
I did. I made that mistake. It's because I was looking at lithium here. I'm sorry. I was reading again. I've got
to
stop.
We'll
that.
Find them as soon as we can get to Rigel 12. Come on.
Yeah. Easy. Yeah, once you get to Rigel 12, there's no problem.
Get to Rigel 12, I mean, it's all set.
Yeah, that's right. You
we
just
get
go
the green
kick
slave
kick
girls, and, you know, everything's going to be great.
I can hardly wait for the green slave girls, yeah.
Okay, look, let's take another quick break, and then let's get into some of the questions from the audience, because we got a whole bunch of them coming in right now.
Oh, no.
Why? Yeah. Okay, Ben, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Chevrolet.
It was more than a car to him. It really was his baby. Oh, no. That's my old Chevy. Dear God.
Okay, this is the part of the show where we get to rapid fire, where we have questions from the audience. And Ben, let's let it rip.
Wow.
Kind of ominous.
It's very ominous.
Okay.
Yeah, I like that.
Oh, wow.
It's like being on The Daily Show. It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, Sandy, WH guest 673 says, can Covetic aluminum be polished or painted? Can I ruin these great qualities by polishing or painting it?
Polishing, yes, and painting, yes. You can do both. I can't imagine why you would, but polishing, I can see how that could enhance the surface finish. I mean, if you... we haven't really looked at it that far down the road, but if you made the skins out of polished aluminum, it'd look cool.
Wow. Okay. Mitch W. says, can Joe White give a ballpark estimate of how much Hyundai will pay over the next several years for its MPG errors?
Ooh. No, I can't, I to be honest with you. I think $100 million is probably not out of the realm of possibility.
Yeah, you think more, Peter?
I think $100 million is like the minimum.
Look, I'll throw this out to all of you guys. Why did American Suzuki need to file for bankruptcy?
Would you miss it?
Yeah,
they were phoning it in for too long, and you know, they're going to keep making bikes and other things, but they just lost it years ago.
Yeah, the U.S. market is awfully crowded, and
right.
and you know what? And there, I'll just add this. I mean, I think in their niche of small, inexpensive cars, there's now quite a throng of small, inexpensive cars from credible car makers, including the Detroit 3, which weren't there before, and just it's a weak brand, and that's what happens.
Yeah.
It's a shame.
Jay Cujo wants to know, since you talked about Covetic aluminum, you've been on the show twice talking about it over the last couple of years, has there been any increase in interest in the material?
Oh, yeah.
Based on you coming on the show?
Absolutely. There was an increase right away. Not only that, that was the impetus for the U.S. government to get involved. Some of that came off this show. I mean, they
Fantastic.
Used that, and so, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That's really cool. Any chance that we'll see it in new cars in the next 2 to 3 years? Doesn't sound like it, based
no,
on what you were
no,
saying.
No, it'd take too long to...
It sounds like infrastructure's got to be put in place to be able to make this stuff.
It's probably going to be a military kind of material for a while. That's usually what happens anyways, even with stainless steel, even though Ford invented it, it took a long time before it got
Ford
into
Ford invented stainless steel?
It was an accident, yeah, at the Rouge complex. Yeah.
No kidding. Hmm. Didn't know that. Rum and Coke says, who is Third Millennium Metals from the Covetic website?
That is the owners of the... Third Millennium Metals is the name of the company, but the website Covetic is the easiest way to get to it.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Ben, I see we got a phone call. Let's bring that one in.
Wow.
Hi, this is Jeff W. from Albany, New York. My question this week is, with Fiat's financial troubles, why don't they sell all or a portion of Ferrari to Chrysler and then use that cash to buy the rest of Chrysler in order to get access to the Chrysler's cash? Thanks. Bye.
Anyone?
I don't know. It seems like kind of selling something to yourself in a sort of a weird way. I think the problem is that Fiat's got problems. I think they'd love to buy out the VEBA that owns the rest of Chrysler and be able to run and consolidate the whole thing. And Sergio Marchionne could move to Detroit, like I think he really wants to do. But I think the selling Ferrari is probably not high on the list of ways to do that.
I've got another idea. Why doesn't Chrysler buy Fiat?
That's a real good idea. I had a lot of comments when the bankruptcies and everything else were happening, and I thought that it might be a good. I thought, and you are a testament to this because you know I've been touting Chrysler for a long time. As soon as I heard Marchionne was coming in, I met that guy a long time ago. I've seen him in action in Europe. I watched that guy. I'm telling you what, I know Alan Mulally quite well from the 777 and the 787 projects that we worked on. But and C-17, but Marchionne impresses me the most. I mean, because it was a lot further down than Ford was. a lot further down. Marchione did, or sorry, not Marchione, but Alan Mulally, he did one great thing. He bankrolled the badge. Even the badge got mortgaged. I mean, he did a great job, but Marchione, for me anyways, is the number one on the hit parade.
Yeah, no, I like the idea of Chrysler buying Fiat right now for a nominal price.
Yeah.
And because Fiat can't get access to any of Chrysler's cash right now. Well, if Chrysler bought Fiat, you know, I think it'd be a whole lot easier to run than the
Let's put it this way. The current ownership structure between Chrysler and Fiat does not look like a stable long-term proposition. So I'm sure there's some investment bankers who are going to earn a nice payday unraveling that setup.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. Danny Boy from Cleveland says, distinguished panel, here in Cleveland, the price of gasoline has come down 35 cents in the last month. The price of diesel has stayed put. What's the deal?
You want to answer that?
Nobody wants diesel. It's not produced at the same levels as what gasoline is. There's a refinery in Ohio. Nobody wants diesel.
My understanding is that diesel prices are sticky for a couple of reasons. One, because they can be, but two, because a lot of that production gets shipped to Europe where they have an installed base of diesel. I think you're right that if you have 55 gallons of oil, you get way less diesel for that unit than you get of gasoline. I might be out of my depth on refining, but that's what I've been told.
I think it's the other way around, but it doesn't matter
because the diesel is in short supply.
Well, you'd think if nobody wants diesel.
Well, it's heating oil also is a problem.
Yeah.
Because it's more or less the same thing, and so to the extent that you're in the heating season in the Northeast,
there's not nearly as much diesel refining capacity as
that's
there
it.
Is
no,
gasoline.
Because right. if you're going toward diesel, it's much easier to make JPA.
The only thing that's
going to
save
that.
Diesel that's... fuel prices is, you know, we had Candace Wheeler here a month ago or so. She's GM's biofuels expert, and there's some interesting biofuel stuff you can do it add to diesel.
Oh, yeah. No, that's
so
been
even without building
on.
One refinery, we could greatly increase the amount of diesel that we use in this country. By using biomass for what they call drop-in fuels.
Yeah.
See how good I sound? How smart I sound?
That's great. Yeah.
That's what happens when you watch Autoline After Hours.
Yeah, you
and the Congress wakes up and starts paying attention to Sandy.
And you and Willie Nelson are going to go into business on biodiesel, so there you go.
Yeah, there you go.
Bio Willie.
Right.
Bad Nikki on Twitter says, the U.S. may have 10 million EVs by 2020. I don't think so.
Where did they get that information?
What was that person's name again?
Not at the current rate.
Bad Nikki.
Bad Nikki. That's right. A bad question.
So he says, the U.S. may have 10 million EVs by 2020. What force will China be here? They have over 100 million EVs currently. Pun intended, he says. But, number one is they don't have 100 million vehicles.
No, I don't know where those numbers
EV
are
EV sales,
from.
And the numbers are out there, EV sales in China are even worse than they are in the United States.
Yeah. Yeah. The Chinese like to make pollution.
Those numbers aren't going to happen without a Nobel Prize-worthy breakthrough in the cost and functionality of a lithium-ion battery or some kind of battery.
Right. Zinc air.
Whatever it is.
Do you know anything about zinc air? That's what Toyota keeps talking about.
Yeah, we've analyzed pretty much every type of battery that's out there. From a cost standpoint and from density and everything else. And
any Nobel Prize winners
out
there?
No, there isn't a single solitary one. The best is probably LG's plastonic battery, we call it. It's probably the best one out there. But again, and the other little surprise, if you drain them down below 20%, you now have a lithium-ion brick. Suitable for framing or filling up
use
that
as a planter.
Nasty hole in the back. Well, you can't even use it for a planter.
The plants don't
like it, no. So that was another little thing we found out. Hey, this battery won't charge. It's brand new. Well, you shouldn't have run it down.
You know, it's just one of those things that if you look at sort of energy history, there are very few examples, and I actually can't think of a one, where on a mass scale, people have substituted a high energy density, cheap, easily transportable fuel for one that is low energy density, costly, and not easily transported or handled. And that's what you're asking for.
And that's
what you're asking for in this case. And I'm not saying that because I think electric cars are a bad idea, that I'm against them on religious grounds. I'm not. I'm just telling you, it's like science and facts. Those are important.
But the only way to really get to a point where we've got an electric vehicle is to experiment. So again, I go back to the Volt. Yeah, I throw them under the bus as far as telling me that the Volt's making money. Bullshit. Nobody's going to tell me that. But by the same token, the engineer should be applauded for coming up with a grand experiment.
With a great car. No. In fact, I really like just about all the electrics I've driven. You know, I think the Nissan Leaf is a very well-done car. Mm-hmm. I think the Focus Electric drives brilliantly well. So, I'm not knocking the cars at all. But I think it's only coming to the showroom because of government mandate, not because there's any kind of market pull.
Well, you know, there's another option. I mean, that 8 you used to drive is now a 6. Well, that 6 you're driving is going to become a 3, and your 4 is going to become a 2. And we're going to slap some turbochargers on there, and superchargers, I should say, not turbo. And guess what? You're going to feel like you're driving your 6 or your 8, and you're going to get all kinds of excitement out of it. And you're not going to be paying as much for gas.
I borrowed a Focus ST from Ford, and they have this sound tube in it to bring the engine note in. And I have to say that it's one of the most appealing aspects of the car. So you hit the gas in this thing, and you really feel like you've got kind of a big 6 or a small 8 in front of you, when really what you've got is a 4-cylinder going like this.
Well,
it's very clever.
We just analyzed the 3 from Ford. We did the 3.
That 1-liter engine?
The Fiesta?
Yeah, the Fiesta, but it's 1-point-something or other.
Yeah, it's 1-liter, I think.
Yeah. Anyways, it's got the new turbocharger that they've developed. It's what they call the EcoBoost over in Europe.
No, they call it that here, too. Mm-hmm.
The EcoBoost is a family of things, but in Europe, it's the only thing that they call EcoBoost, I believe.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, so you got to ask for the right engine. It took us a long time. Actually, thank you very much, Ford guys. Ford Heaven, they got it for me. I couldn't get it. I couldn't get one of those things. You had to buy a whole damn car, and when they came in, they were already sold. So to get that thing, I had to call in some chips. And, please, we want this job. We'll do anything. And we got that, and then compared it to a couple of other 2-cylinder engines that are one's out and the other one's...
Is that the new turbo from Continental?
The turbo is...
Or is that BorgWarner?
Not Continental. You know what? You've stumped me. I forgot. But I'm telling you what, the materials inside are magnificent. They're using some ultra high temperature stuff, probably because the ultra high temperature stuff is also easier to form. That's the biggest scrap rate, is that little turbine inside. It doesn't fare well at I don't know what it is in there, probably around 2,500 degrees or something. It gets plenty hot, so it's got
a lot
of magic.
Where are these 2-cylinder engines being sold?
One is being sold in Italy.
Yeah, Fiat has a 2-cylinder.
It's right. It's called the Twin Air.
Yeah. Okay.
The Twin Air, yeah.
That's
okay.
Good.
You called last question actually goes to Peter. Newcastle guy says, which car company do you predict is going to have the best lease deals for the end of the year? Are Mercedes and BMW going to duke it out?
Oh, they already are.
And well, what the hell's that about,
Peter?
Yeah,
I just wrote about that. Go ahead, Peter.
You first. Joe, you go first because you wrote about it. I mean, it's just today, right? It's just like
it's guns or knives, and they started the first weekend after Halloween. You know, it's like Christmas for 2 months of the year.
Yeah, Mercedes is running their snow ads now
with Santa Claus.
Yeah,
right.
It's just
BMW is $3,500. That they're advertising. I there could well be additional ways to get more money. Mercedes, same kind of thing. $750 if you stay loyal. $750 if you defect. You know, it's a great time to be in the market for a luxury German car.
Well, what's going on with these guys? I mean, this has got to hurt their brand image if they keep this up.
Well, yeah, it's ego. Pure, flat-out ego. They don't want the others to prevail. But, yeah, you diminish the brand when you do that stuff.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't think they'll do what Cadillac did. Remember a few years ago, 8 years ago, where they sort of reported sales that weren't really there to beat Lincoln.
Right.
Boy, that sounds like ancient history, doesn't it?
Right. To remain number one in the U.S. market. Right. Yeah, at the moment. Yeah.
But, it's going nowhere good. I can tell you that.
No,
I
mean, it can't be good. And, these are companies that always, at least in the past, said, we're not going to fight to be number one. If we get there, we get there. But we're going to build just great cars, and we're going to let it happen. And now it's like they're like the bad old Detroit of 5 years ago.
Yeah. Brand image is absolutely key. And Audi does it much more. It's subtle the way Audi does it. It's much better.
Yeah, Audi, yeah, I agree. Audi seems not to be. For instance, Mercedes will get by the last 5 months of your lease. Audi's told me anyway, we're not going to play that game. I mean, they've got lease deals out there and they're doing this and that, but they're not going to play that game. I did think though, and I talked to people at all these companies, and I came away with this sort of intuition about what they're up to, and I pretty much agree with what Peter said on a lot of this. But I think there's maybe a business reason here that's legit, and that is that the market is finally coming back. I mean, it came back last year, but now it really seems to be coming back. You've got people back in the marketplace after a number of years, and even in the luxury segments. What time to grab these people and have promotions to grab these people and grab as many people as you can into your brand where you can then work your loyalty programs until the end of time than now. If you miss them now, you know, they'll be in the other guy's camp. You have this big cadre or cohort, rather, of people coming back. So I think that may be a legit motivation for this. It's like they're coming back. Let's grab as many of them as we can. And I got to tell you, the two brands that are going to suffer, as the elephants tromp around with their great cars that they have to sell, and that's Cadillac and Lincoln. It's going to be tough for them to get on the shopping list when Audi, Mercedes, and BMW are being as promotional as they are right now.
See, I'm looking at it a little bit differently. I see that Dieter Zetsche, the head of Mercedes-Benz Daimler, is under enormous pressure right now because BMW's outperforming them in the showroom and on the bottom line financially. So he's under a bunch of pressure now that he's got to show that they can be as good as BMW in China, which they're not, or Audi, which they're not. They've stumbled a little bit here. They used to be the number one luxury brand, or were for a couple of years, in the U.S. market. BMW has clawed its way past them. And so I think the word's gone out to both the head of BMW and Mercedes in the U.S. You better be number one or else.
Yeah, well, there's no question. I think Mercedes, for the record, denies in the U.S., denies that they're just doing this to be number one. But there was no question when I did my little rounds on this that they want to be competitive. They're prepared to be extremely competitive. I think the customer is the winner, as usual, in these deals. And we'll see how it all shakes out. And they're both predicting. In fact, several of these companies are predicting record November and December results. You know, record their own records. And again, that's
but is
easy
that just
going to
be
measure.
A pull forward? Maybe not. Maybe based on what you're saying, there's enough new people coming.
Well,
into
I think
the
that's their
now.
Bet. And again, I mean, this goes back to the way beginning of our show here, where that's all great unless the economy tumbles off its chair. Lands on the barroom floor. Yeah. That would not be good for anybody. Right.
Well, on that happy note, we ought to wrap up the show. But Sandy, thanks so much for coming in.
Well, thank you very much.
Bringing
for
stuff. They're really
Sandy,
good stuff.
Always a pleasure to see you.
Yeah. Thank you.
It was fun.
Thanks for
Joe White,
good
great you. Having you here, too.
Good
Joe,
to be here.
Joe, always good to see you. And Jen.
Yeah, good seeing you. And we should let everybody know next week we'll have the chief engineer of the Ford Fusion here, John Jarache. So we'll have a Fusion in the studio, talk a bunch of Fusion
That's
stuff.
That's always good when we have the people directly responsible for the product right here.
Right
here on our stage.
That's right. Well, hey, everybody, thanks for having tuned in tonight. Really love having you here.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion. And by Chevrolet, Chevy runs deep.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.